Hello and welcome to the next Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm Neil Denny and I'm at a lovely leafy suburb of Palo Alto in California, and I'm really excited to be about to talk to Leonard Susskind. Leonard Susskind has been the Felix Bloch Professor in Theoretical Physics at Stanford University since 1978. He is a member of the National Academy of Science and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the recipient of numerous prizes, including the Science Writing Prize of the American Institute of Physics for a Scientific American article on black holes. He is the author of a number of books of popular science, including The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design, and the book we look at in this interview, The Black Hole War, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. His contributions to physics include the discovery of string theory and the holographic principle, both of which have completely changed the landscape of modern theoretical physics. Leonard Susskind has been a lifelong advocate of progressive politics, something else we touch upon in this interview. Leonard Susskind, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
You're welcome.
We're going to be talking in the main about your book, The Black Hole War, but perhaps let's talk a brief little bit of background. Let's talk about how you became a physicist, perhaps.
Oh dear, it was so long ago. When I first started to think about being a physicist, I knew very, very little about it, almost nothing. I came from a family that was working class. I expected to be a plumber. My father sent me to college. He said, you have to go to college so that you can learn a little bit about heating engineering so that we can put in boilers into tenement buildings. And in fact, I really do remember it very well. He said, there's this thing called a BTU. Now, that's a British thermal unit, in case. And he didn't know what it was. Well, you go to college and find out what a BTU was. So I went to college. I never actually found out exactly what a BTU is, but I studied engineering for a while. And engineering just didn't appeal to me for a number of reasons. My mind doesn't work that way, and it wasn't really what I wanted to do. At some point, I was basically told by an engineering professor, you should not be an engineer, you should be a scientist. So I started scouting around in this was at CCNY, New York City College in New York. I started scouting around and asking various science professors whether I could do this or that. And for one reason or another, I settled down on physics, not knowing very much about it. I had taken one or two physics classes, but very elementary, and I knew I liked it. I loved mathematics. I was good at mathematics. I knew I liked it, but I honestly had absolutely no idea that it was a live, living subject, that people were still discovering things. As far as I knew, all of physics had been completed by 200-year-old dead men in Europe, of course. But one of the professors, a person who became a good friend of mine, Harry Sudak, took me under his wing a little bit, started to explain to me what it was all about, that physics was not only not finished, but we knew much less than there was to know. You know, you could make a career out of it. You could make, if you were good at it, you could be a professor. You could spend your life doing science and doing research, teaching people. And I got hooked. So I decided not to be a plumber.
So the book, The Black Hole War, is mainly concerned with a disagreement between yourself and Stephen Hawking. But before we actually get to the meat of the disagreement, we should perhaps take a look at some of the concepts that you cover in the book. The obvious one from the title is black hole. People will be familiar with black holes, but perhaps we should, to lay some of the background for what comes later in the discussion, let's talk a little bit about the discovery of the idea of black holes and where it comes from, really, I guess.
Well, of course, like almost everything in physics, it came from Einstein. Einstein discovered the general... Actually, it goes back earlier. It goes back to Laplace, who was, of course, one of the great Frenchman scientists of early 19th century. And even before him, a man, I'm tempted to say Wallace, but of course Wallace that's the wrong person. Wallace was the one who invented Darwinian evolution. Mitchell was his name, a Brit. And he got interested in the question of what would happen if a star was so dense and so heavy, so concentrated, that the escape velocity, the velocity that it would take to escape from the surface of the star, would exceed the speed of light. Then wouldn't it follow that light couldn't escape from the star? And of course, if light couldn't escape from the star because gravity pulled it back down somehow, wouldn't it mean that the star was just dark? Wouldn't it mean that the star was invisible? And he did some calculations. Laplace did the same calculations. And what they discovered was a sort of proto-theory of black holes. They discovered that the combination of the mass and the size of the star, if the star was too small for a given mass, if it was too heavy for its own size, then it could trap light, according to their calculations at the time. It was forgotten. Nobody remembered it very much because nobody really thought that light fell back down onto an object due to gravity. They didn't think that until Einstein. And Einstein demonstrated and proved within his own theory, the general theory of relativity, that yes, gravity does affect light. It pulls it back down. And the result, it wasn't actually Einstein who derived it. It was a gentleman by the name of Schwarzschild who derived the properties of a very, very concentrated mass and showed that basically stars, and if they become heavy enough, will collapse under their own weight. They'll squash down to an infinitesimally small point, and they'll be surrounded by what we call a horizon today. Mm-hmm. The horizon is exactly that place the light cannot escape from.
Okay, so let's look at that horizon a little bit closer. You talked about Schwarzschild?
Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild.
Well, I suppose you would say Schwarzschild. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, I'm not sure I've got that right either.
And he was the first to posit this, the idea of that horizon. So
actually, that turns out not to be quite right.
Oh, okay.
Schwarzschild knew that there was something funny that happened at a certain distance from the center of the black hole. It's the place that we call a horizon today. But he didn't know what it was, and he didn't quite get the physical idea right. That took quite a while, and I believe it was David Finkelstein who first realized that the horizon was a sort of one-way, almost a membrane that things could fall into but could not fall back out of. So I think, if I understand correctly, and it was a good friend of mine, David Finkelstein, but that wasn't the point. I think he is generally credited as the first one who understood what a horizon really is. It's a sort of point of no return.
Mm-hmm.
It's a point of no return. When anything falls through the horizon, it's gone. It cannot get back out without exceeding the speed of light. Why not? Because gravity pulls it back in.
Okay, so the next concept that I think we should look at, and I particularly want to discuss this because I, in the course of doing this radio show, get to read quite a lot of popular physics books,
right.
And I've actually never read a better explanation of entropy.
Well, that's okay. I never wrote a better one.
this book. So let's talk about what is entropy.
Yeah, entropy, all right, first, the first concept is information. Information means distinctions. It means distinctions between something could be red or it could be blue. That's a bit of information. Well, that's some information. A coin could be heads, a coin could be tails. That is literally a bit of information in the technical sense. Mm-hmm. It's either up or down. So information is about distinctions between things, and it comes in bits. It comes in a unit called a bit.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, sometimes information is totally observable easily. If I flip a coin on the table and you look at it, you can see immediately whether it's heads or tails. So that information is not hidden.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes information is terribly hidden. For example, if we have a huge number of molecules in a bathtub, warm water, there's an enormous amount of information in the precise location of every single molecule. That information distinguishes one configuration of the molecules from another. If I just move a molecule a little bit, it's different. A bathtub full of hot water is different. But it's completely unobservable, not in principle, but in practice, because there are just too many molecules, they're too small to see, they're too numerous to keep track of, and so that becomes hidden information. Information which is just unavailable because for one reason or another, it's hidden from view, either because you can't see it because it's behind the brick wall, but it can also be hidden, and this is usually the situation, just because it's contained in too many molecules too smaller molecules, just too much of it, so to speak. And once there's too much of it, you can't keep track of it. Hidden information is called entropy. That's what entropy is, hidden information.
So how does that relate then to the idea of the second law of thermodynamics?
Well, the second law of thermodynamics simply says that information tends to get lost and scrambled among this large number of degrees of freedom. We call them degrees of freedom, molecules. An example would be you drop a little bit of ink into a bathtub full of water. Maybe you drop the ink in a series of drops that spell out a word. Okay, my name is Leonard or whatever. And that ink, for a little bit of time, is observable information. Now, the ink molecules get hit by the water molecules. They get scattered around. They get beaten up. And they get diffused or spread throughout all of the water. And eventually, all you see is a gray, little bit of grayness in the water. Totally impossible to read what the message was. So the information that was put in becomes hidden, becomes lost. It's easy to imagine how hard it would be and how unlikely it would be for the ink molecules to rearrange themselves and suddenly spell out again my name. That's very, very unlikely to happen. That's an example of the second law of thermodynamics. Things get more and more scrambled, more and more confused with time. But that information never really gets lost. It's there in those ink molecules. It's there if only you had the ability to look at every single molecule, which would clearly take somebody quite superhuman.
Before we move on to the disagreement, there's one other, going back to black holes, another discovery, and this is the idea that black holes have a temperature.
Even before that, black holes have entropy. That came even before. Entropy, as I said, is hidden information. And of course, when you throw something into a black hole and that disappears behind the horizon, some information got lost behind the black hole horizon. It was a gentleman by the name of Bekenstein, Jacob Bekenstein, who quantified the idea, that black holes have information and it's hidden and therefore it's entropy. Now, whenever a system has entropy and it has energy, and black holes certainly have energy, they also have temperature. Temperature goes together. Energy, entropy, and temperature all go together. They're sort of triplets that are inseparable. So it followed that the black hole, since it has entropy and since it has energy, must have a temperature. And Stephen Hawking was the one who worked out most clearly, most decisively, what the temperature of a black hole is.
Let's move on to the actual disagreement that you had with Stephen Hawking. And so, Steve, what was Stephen's initial idea that caused it? Because actually it sounds to a layman to be not particularly earth-shattering.
No, right. Okay, that's right. Doesn't sound so very different than a puddle of water on the floor. You lose information into the puddle of water. Not that you lose it, it becomes hard to disentangle. What Stephen did, first of all, was to recognize that if a black hole has a temperature, then it will evaporate. That was extremely important. It was an enormous discovery. Everybody thought that black holes were just totally dead objects. They would last forever. Nothing would ever happen to them. And in fact, Stephen discovered that because of this combination of energy, entropy, temperature, that black holes would evaporate. They would radiate away their energy in the form of photons, but it doesn't matter that they were photons. Just particles coming out would eventually cause the black hole to disappear. And that created, for Stephen, as well as everybody else, a big puzzle. Things fall into the black hole. They carry information, meaning to say that they encode distinctions. I could throw into the black hole a book by me, or I could throw in a black hole a book by Stephen. Two different things thrown in. And according to the rules of physics, that memory, the memory of what was initiated the black hole or initiated the process, must never really be forgotten. It may get scrambled. It may get very, very hard to read that book after it's come out of the black hole as Hawking radiation. But still, the rules of physics said nothing is ever allowed to disappear. No information, no bit of information is ever allowed to disappear. Now, that was a problem, because on the one hand, when something falls through a horizon, it can't get back out without exceeding the speed of light. Nothing can exceed the speed of light. so it can't get back out. On the other hand, the black hole evaporates and disappears, and if those distinctions cannot get back out, and the black hole disappears, there's nothing left to remember what went in. And that, it may not seem like much of a big deal, but it absolutely undermined the basic principles of physics as we know it. If it were true, it would have not just been a revolution, it would have undermined just about everything we know about the way physics works. The second law of thermodynamics, how information is encoded, everything from Newton to Heisenberg would have been absolutely undermined. Didn't seem to me that was right, but I couldn't figure out what was wrong with what Stephen was saying. Yes, black holes evaporate. Yes, things can fall through the horizon. Yes, once they're through the horizon, they can't get back out. Then the black hole evaporates. All these things were true, and nevertheless, something felt wrong. It wasn't only to me. It was also to Gerard at Hooft, the great Dutch physicist, who also felt something is wrong. But neither one of us were able to put our finger on it at that time.
So then what happened?
Well,
let's get to the... How do we get to your... Well, I want to get to the concept of the holographic universe, I guess. But
yeah,
let's talk about what happens in between. How do you set about proving this incredible concept is wrong? How do you set about proving that Stephen Hawking, the most famous physicist in the world, possibly is incorrect?
You know, first of all, be clear about one thing, that Stephen didn't make a mistake, or at least if he made a mistake, it was an exceedingly profound mistake, exceedingly profound. He raised and addressed a question that whether or not he got the answer right, the question itself led to a revolution in physics. And this is not a win-lose situation. I would say in some sense everybody won here. Profound new thoughts came out of profound questions. What I began to realize, and I think what at Hooft, my colleague in the Netherlands, began to realize, is that the surface of a black hole, the horizon, the thing that's called the horizon, was very much like a hologram, that the things that fell into a black hole let's talk about a hologram for a minute. A hologram is a piece of film. That's all it is. It's a piece of film, and if you look at the piece of film under a microscope, all you see is a bunch of scratchy, noisy, random markings. Very random, very unelucidating if you tried to read what the hologram was about. On the other hand, you know that that hologram contains all of the information in a complete three-dimensional picture. The hologram itself is two-dimensional. It's a piece of film. On the other hand, it has stored in it everything about an entire three-dimensional scene. The reality of the three-dimensional figure and the two-dimensional description of it on the surface of the film, they're two different representations of the same reality. There's a three-dimensional image that's made by shining light on the hologram, and there's the two-dimensional actual piece of film. We began to realize that there's something very, very similar about the horizon of a black hole. It's two-dimensional. It's a surface. On the other hand, the things that fall into the black hole are three-dimensional objects. They fall into the black hole before they get to the singularity, before they get crushed. They've fallen through the horizon of the black hole. They're just ordinary things. You could fall through the horizon of an extremely big black hole. Not much would happen to you when you fell through the horizon. And you're three-dimensional. You're not squashed out and flattened onto the horizon. On the other hand, what comes out of the black hole is like the little bits, the tiny bits of the surface of the horizon. Somehow, that horizon, when it evaporates, had all the information about the things that fell in. And what we discovered after a while is that the mathematics of the black hole was in many ways similar to the mathematics of a hologram. Two different descriptions of the same reality. The three-dimensional stuff that falls into the black hole and the two-dimensional film that it leaves on the surface of the black hole, which evaporates. That turned out to be the answer, that the surface of a black hole contains the same information as the things that fall into the black hole, two representations of the same thing. That revolutionized the whole subject. It revolutionized all of physics, I would say, and it became known as the holographic principle, that, first of all, in the context of a black hole, that there's two different representations of reality, one this surface film that we call The Horizon, which is full of little random scratches and little random bits of information, and the physical things which fall into the black hole. They're really the same thing. They're not two different things. That idea got generalized by both Ed Hooft and myself into a broader idea that since if a black hole is big enough, an entire galaxy could fall into it. More than a galaxy, a supercluster of galaxies could fall into it. So it sounded like the entire universe could be thought of as being on the surface of a giant, giant black hole. Well, you don't really need the black hole anymore. You can now just say the entire universe can be coded and described by a two-dimensional film out near the boundaries of the universe. And that became known as the holographic principle. Most physicists who are aware of these things are, I think it has really changed the face of physics. And much of physics now revolves around exploring and using this concept.
You describe the holographic principle in the book as not being enough to refute Stephen's idea. So how does this then tie into string theory,
Oh. It wasn't that the holographic principle itself was not enough. It was that nobody believed the holographic principle.
Not enough to convince people that it was...
I shouldn't say nobody. Some of the smartest people I knew did buy into it very quickly. But the general broad majority of physicists, you know, both Ed Hooft and myself were well-known physicists, extremely well-known. But people scratched their head and they said, well, you know, these guys used to be good physicists. What happened to them? What do you mean the world is a hologram? That's pretty silly. The idea hung around for a while. A few string theorists, Ed Witten, a few others, sort of thought maybe there's something right there. But a young Argentinian physicist by the name of Juan Maldacena, and when I say Argentinian, he's in the United States and has been in the United States since graduate school. Around 1997, I guess, sometime around 1997, realized that he could find a very, very precise version, a really exact mathematical version of this holographic idea where, with very precise mathematics, he could show that a certain world, and by world I mean a certain mathematical description of a possible world, had this property of having two descriptions, the three-dimensional description and the boundary surface description, like a hologram. Mm-hmm. Once he had made his calculations, and his calculations were very, very precise, there was no question. Everybody realized, yes, this holographic idea is right, and it was a watershed point where a thing which had been largely considered the goofy idea of a couple of guys who were past their prime, perhaps, suddenly gelled and became consensus physics. That's a nice thing to happen.
Yeah, and that's a good point to end that part of the discussion. Right. We've spent some time talking about wild ideas of theoretical physics.
Yeah.
Now let's come back down to Earth. During this journey across America, I'm particularly interested in the fact that I'm here during the election year. So let's spend some time talking about what your hopes are for this upcoming presidential election.
Oh, dear. Well, I hope my candidate wins. Now you're going to ask me which candidate.
Yeah.
Look, I'm a Democrat. I've always been a Democrat. I've been a Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt. I was actually alive during Franklin Roosevelt, even though I was only 5 years old. But I grew up in a working-class family that prospered, and I prospered because of I won't call it the social welfare, I will call it the social justice of having free education, of a college in New York City which was free. My parents survived the Depression because of the policies of Franklin Roosevelt. I came from a Jewish background, but the background that I came from was completely non-religious, or if I should say that we had a religion, the religion was social justice. I came from a family that felt very, very strongly about that, and I guess I still do. I find, frankly, what's going on in the United States, the injustice of a select group of people, it's sometimes called the 1%, but I suspect it's much smaller than the 1%, a select group of people running away with all of the resources, all of the wealth of the country, and at the same time using fear and using prejudice to whip up a political atmosphere which keeps them in power, I find that a complete violation of everything that I've ever believed in from the time I was a child. I'm a Democrat. I believe that the Democrats are more attuned with my own sense of social justice. And when I say social justice, look, I don't need social justice anymore. I'm a famous professor of physics and all that stuff. I make a very good living. I don't need that social justice anymore. But there is a whole generation of young people that are facing a decline, facing a enormous debt in order to get educated, something that I got for free. And I find that just despicable. I find it a despicable situation. My sense is that President Obama is on the right side of these things and the other candidate is not.
As a lifelong Democrat, and if I was American, I would also be so. So we both want Obama to win. But how do you think, how has he performed in this first term, do you think? Because we get the impression from Europe that a lot of people are disappointed. Yeah.
Well, of course, there is disappointment. But I don't think it has to do with the way Obama has performed. I think it has to do with the constraints that he faced because of the way the other side has performed. The other side has made it purposefully, absolutely impossible for the country to be governed in the way that it should be governed. This was not Obama's fault that there was such a concentration of bad will within the legislature that prevented anything from being done. It is not his fault that the wealthy are taxed at a 15% rate and the middle class is taxed at a 30% rate. This is the fault of an obstructionist, destructive Tea Party mentality. I think he performed pretty darn good under the circumstances. We may have an improvement of health care if the whole thing isn't undone by the forces of, it's called conservative, incidentally. I very much bridle at the idea that these people are conservative. They are not conservative. I'm conservative. I'm a conservative person. I don't go out and do wild things. I have a family. My family is very important to me. Family values are important to me. To call the policies that call the policies of the Republican Party, quite frankly, conservative, is a misuse of the term. It is not conservative. It is reactionary. So that's where I stand. I don't think Obama did that badly, frankly. I don't understand what it is that he did so badly about, other than in the beginning trying to accommodate two points of view, which failed. It's true. He failed to recognize just how nasty the situation was going to get. Maybe he failed to recognize it. But I think in the end he prevented a lot worse from happening than what did happen.
So what you've just said might have an impact on my next question then, but we know what we want with our hearts. We know you want Obama to win. I said that in Europe we had this idea that a lot of the people that heard his election was an incredible event, and it seemed like there was some sort of big transformation coming. You know, the campaign was sort of revolutionary in the amount of people that got on the street and the social media voting and everything. Like I said, it seems from a distance a lot of those people are disappointed. Although that election happened, it was an amazing thing. It was still quite a close run thing. Yeah. So what I'm getting to is, with your head, how do you rate his chances this time? I mean, do you think it's going to be tough?
Oh, it's certainly going to be tough. Of course it's going to be tough.
But do you think he can win?
I think he'll win. Yeah, I do think he'll win. I may be wrong. Look, I'm not a political consultant. I'm not a political scientist. All I can do is watch from my position here in California. And, of course, in California here, it's a very liberal state. Mm-hmm. And so I may get a slightly misleading view of things. Possible that things are much more ugly out there than... but, you know, I'm not so sure. It's hard for me to tell what's my belief and what's my hope. Mm-hmm. How to distinguish hope from belief. I hope that Obama will win. Do I believe he'll win? Yeah, I think I do, but we'll only know when it happens. But I think the idea of being disappointed with him is misguided. Mm-hmm. I think it's really misguided. He did as well, I think, as anybody could do. I do think he made a mistake in the very, very beginning of not doing more to help the working class, and I mean the white working class, to create an image in their mind that he was their protector. He might have done better, I think, in the very beginning in the foreclosure issue, for example. He might have done better fighting the battle for the lower working class elements in the country. But I think that was there was a very short time that he could have done better. And then the options sort of closed down. And what he did after that, I thought, was just fine, because I think he protected the country from a lot worse abuse than would have happened without him. I frankly think he's a very tough character. I don't think he was the kind of pushover that some people think he was. Not at all.
I wonder if you have an opinion on why America itself has gone in the direction it has. I don't know if you're familiar. I'm a fan of the journalist Thomas Frank. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, but he wrote this book called What's the Matter with Kansas?
He
describes growing up in a similar background to yourself, in a sort of working class leftist background in Kansas. And of course, we're talking about, you know, his family talking about the time of the Depression, I guess, and they were union members, and the Democratic Party was strong there. And now you look at those sort of states, and they're the heartland of the Republican Party.
Right. So. Well, if he's as old as I am, he grew up in a time when the Democratic Party was two different parties. There was the Southern Democrat Party, which was the party of Jim Crow. And there was the Northern Democratic Party, which was the liberal social justice party. They managed to win elections by just holding their nose and using each other. Sometime around 1968, Lyndon Johnson, who may have been a monster, but he had the right feelings toward the poor, toward the working class, and especially toward racial issues in the United States, he took the Democratic Party straight forward into liberal social justice issues, and it deeply, deeply offended the South. And the next thing we knew, Nixon had his Southern strategy. He flipped the Democratic Party in the South, and all of that stuff became the Republican Party of the South. That's what happened. That is what happened, and it has never changed. The other thing which happened is the Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was a nice man. He had a wonderful smile. He had a terrific voice. Am I allowed to use... how clean does my language have to be?
Not at all.
He was an asshole. What he convinced the country of is that the biggest danger was government. And at a time, and especially now, what we need more than anything else is protection by the government from the forces that are tending to divide the country into the very, very wealthy and everybody else. We need the government. We need the government for health care. We need the government for all kinds of things. And Reagan convinced the public, what was that guy's name, who said he wants to see the government shrunk to the size where it could be put in a bathtub and drowned? Well, that was Reaganism. It wasn't Reagan who said that, but that was pure Reaganism. And what people don't seem to understand is that if you shrink the government to the size where you can drown it in the bathtub, you're shrinking the country to the size where you can drown it in the bathtub. But there's all sorts of things now going on that I think the public is deeply confused about. For example, there's a big fear of inflation. Now, people like me, who have been around long enough, survived because of inflation. We bought houses when I was 28 years old. I bought a house that I couldn't afford. My father before me bought a house that he couldn't afford. My whole generation bought houses, cars, all sorts of things that we couldn't afford at the time, but because of inflation, our debt went down, the effective debt value of the debt went down, and we found ourselves after 5, 6, 7 years, okay. We were all right with the things that what we had, let's put it this way, what we had invested in, our houses and other things. Inflation was a thing that made things work, that made things possible. And of course, who is harmed by inflation? Who is harmed by inflation is the people who hold the debt, the banks, the wealthy people who hold the debt. They don't want to see their debt diminished, but somehow the public has become afraid of inflation, right? At the same time that inflation ended, I don't think people don't seem to have noticed this. At the same time that inflation ended, that's when people stopped being able to afford their mortgages. All of a sudden, people no longer could look ahead to their mortgages diminishing in value because of inflation, foreclosures all over the place. So people are just worried about the wrong thing. They're worried about national debt. Now, the national debt has nothing whatever to do with the debt of a family. A family is a small unit. A small unit is typically in debt to other units. If you're a small family and you're in debt, who are you in debt to? You're in debt to somebody else. You're in debt to the bank. You're in debt to your credit card. You're in debt to all sorts of other people. And those people are not going to be nice to you. But who is the government in debt to? The answer is, for the most part, they're in debt to the people of the United States. There is no debt other than the debt that the government owes people within the United States, a certain amount, Social Security and so forth. It's like a family owing itself money. Families don't become destroyed if they owe each other money. The government is not in an existential crisis where it's going to disappear and disintegrate, or the country is going to disintegrate because we all owe each other money. And for the most part, we would do a lot better if the government would say we are going to fix the debt problem by increasing taxes, especially increasing that. You know, if you have a family that has a bunch of rich people and a bunch of poor people, and they all have their money in a common big bank account, and the bank account starts getting drained, the right thing to do is to tell the rich people in the family to put more money into the bank to cover it. Not to say, we'll take what money exists and give it to the rich people. I mean, it's a sort of insanity that doesn't make any sense. The country is not going to die because of debt to its own people. It's going to die, it's not going to die, but it's going to be harmed by the fear of debt, because what the fear of debt does is it prevents the country from spending money. If the country doesn't spend money, unemployment gets increased. If unemployment gets increased, people are out of work, they can't pay taxes, the government has less money, fewer people can be supported I'm not talking about by charity. I'm talking about by the fact that the government is continuously spending money on all kinds of things which employs people. In fact, I'm employed by I'm employed by the government. You think I'm employed by Stanford University. Well, the government puts plenty of money into Stanford University in the form of research grants. So I am employed by the government in that sense. I would guess that the fraction of the population that in one way or another receives its income through the government is very high, and they don't even realize it. So when they say they want to shrink government, what they're really talking about is depression, deflation, the shrinking of everything. And it's frightening the extent to which people don't understand what they're talking about.
One more question then, and particularly keen to look at how science itself is affected by politics and the election year. And perhaps we should look at a way in which a particular scientific issue is politicised and the impact that that's going to have on the election. I'm thinking particularly of climate change and the way I'm interested to talk about the way that climate
changes.
That's
exactly right. Of course, I don't know how the election is going to affect these things, because we don't really know what politicians are going to do when they get into power. What is quite frightening, though, is the tendency to completely dismiss scientific knowledge, both, especially, of course, climate change, but not just climate change, their theory of evolution, all of these things, making political footballs out of them. That is quite frightening, that some of the most important things in the world, such as, well, economics is also a science, economics and science of climate change, biology, stem cell research, all of that sort of stuff now is become political footballs, which is being used to drum up a certain ignorant segment of the population and scaring them, prejudicing them for purely self-interested political purposes. So this is pretty scary. This is pretty upsetting. The question of whether science is going to have its funding cut. Right. Let's be blunt. That's kind of what it's about. Nobody is going to. Well, Is science going to be cut? I have no idea. I do not know. I've always worried from the very beginning when I first became a scientist. Every year I would say, what's going to happen when the next government gets into power, whoever it happens to be? You know, it used to be the Republicans who supported science and Democrats a little bit less so. There's been, again, a reversal in that respect. I don't know whether the Republicans will fund science. That's a different issue. But that they don't support the scientific way of thinking, this is clear. This is clear. They do not support the scientific way of thinking about economics. They don't support the scientific way of thinking about biology. They don't support the scientific way of thinking about climate change. Instead, they operate on people's emotions and fears. So that, to me, is a worse problem than the specific problem of funding particular research projects. But whether the government will continue to support science as healthily as it has up till now, I don't know. I certainly hope so.
That's a perfect point for us to end then. So, Leonard Susskind, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm Priya Natarajan. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.